This is the 16th anniversary of a classic for ufologists. It's the story of the Braxton County Monster. When this story broke, it stretched the imagination of many people the world over. And the story has been told and retold in the past 16 years in just about every country in the world. And when this happened, Alvin Sanderson, the world-renowned naturalist, world traveler, author, was asked by True Magazine and the North American Newspaper Alliance to come to West Virginia to get the facts about the Braxton County Monster for True Magazine and for a series in North American Newspaper Alliances. So in 1953, I got in touch with Long John Neville, a close friend of ours for many, many years, in New York City, and told him at that time to get a tape for me interviewing Ivan Sanderson about his investigation of the Braxton County Monster. And this also was investigated by Gray Barker, who is from Clarksburg, West Virginia, the author of They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers and many other stories about flying saucers. So we start the program going back to the year that this happened, 16 years ago, the appearance of the Braxton County Monster, as told by Ivan Sanderson.
This morning we're talking with Ivan Sanderson, the gentleman that investigated the West Virginia Monster. And we have Walter Rochette with us, and we also have Donald Cohn with us. Now, Hugh McPherson, who is the all-night man at the station in, I think it's Charlestown, West Virginia.
Charlestown.
Mm-hmm. He's been very interested in getting the facts about the famous West Virginia Monster. I think Gray Barker was the author of a book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. And if I'm not mistaken, Ivan, you investigated the
Gray.
West Virginia Monster.
Gray and I were there at the same time, as a matter of fact, along with a lot of other newspaper reporters.
Well, now we're taping this portion of this morning's show, and we're going to send this tape down to Hugh McPherson.
Gray.
Incidentally, Hugh McPherson has a minor bird that works with him on the program.
Oh, yes, I know his name, and I know of his work, too. A good minor bird, yeah.
Well, supposing you tell us something about the West Virginia Monster.
Are you ready with the tape?
Well, it's going right now.
Uh-huh. Well, Hugh, I'd like to try and put it in a nutshell as follows, as I said before. First of all, I went down there about 5 or 6 days after the occurrence took place at the request of the North American Newspaper Alliance, for whom I do some reporting work and special representation, and also on behalf of True Magazine. It was Ken Purdy of True Magazine who, when running out of his office one day on some private business, picked at random out of a mass of clippings that used to come to his desk every day a perfectly ridiculous statement that a 12-foot green monster with red glowing eyes had been seen on a mountaintop at Flatwood in I think it's Saxton County, isn't it? West Virginia. I didn't know I was going to be asked to tell you about this tonight, so if my names are wrong, forgive me. And he gave this report, Ken Purdy, to John DuBarry of True Magazine, who was their aviation editor and was interested in flying saucers and such, and said, get a hold of Ivan Sanderson, have him get down there and see what this is all about. Ken Purdy had an absolute genius of picking a news story. So I was rung up and asked to go down. So my assistant, Eddie Schoenberger, and I, we jumped in an old taxi cab we had at the time, and we took off. I may say that on the way down, we went through the worst rainstorm that I have witnessed anywhere in the world. And I've lived in Assam, and I've lived right on Cape Dabuncha in West Africa, which are the two points of highest rainfall in the world, but I have never seen rain like we had on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Well, we rolled into Flatwoods the next morning.
That's Flatwoods, West Virginia?
Yeah.
Ivan.
Saxton County, I think, S-A-X-T-O-N County, West Virginia. It's in the mountains. It is north of Charleston, West Virginia.
How do the roads there compare with those in Europe?
What, in the hills?
Mm.
Oh, excellent. They have very good motor roads going through. Of course, there are an enormous number of little dirt roads going up into the hills because there's been extensive mining throughout that entire area. If you fly over it, you will see mine heads and mine shafts everywhere, and the tops of these wooded hills are completely covered with these dirt roads. Well, to make a long story short, this is what we found out during our investigations. There were 14 all told, a number of young young people, kids and up to the age of 14, who are playing football on a small field in the bottom of a little valley in the village of Flatwood. The village of Flatwood is at one end of this little valley. It's ringed around by mountains, as you down there will probably know better than I do, or our other listeners up here. Now, through this valley runs a road, a blacktop road, going from north to south, also a railway line, a railway track. And at the opposite end of this little valley to the village is a small railroad station. And there is a dirt road that crosses the rail tracks, leading off the blacktop, just by that rail station, then curves up round the back of one of these mountains and sort of peters out at a field. And up that road, stuck on the side of this hill, I would say, a very stony hill, are a number of dwellings. Up on the top, at the back of the mountain, there are four or five rather larger houses. One of those houses is occupied by a family by the name of May. The lady, Mrs. May, if I remember right, is principally concerned in this affair. These kids were playing just before sundown, down on this field at the bottom of the village. And one of the kids looked up, and one of the little ones, I differentiate between kids and young people. Say, kids, the 5, 6, 7-year-olds, and the young people above that, you see. But one of the kids looked up, and he said, in so many words, "What on earth is that?" And they all looked around, and round the edge of a hill, behind the village, the north of the village, but lower than the peak of that hill, or the one opposite it, came a pear-shaped, glowing red object, which was pulsing from cherry red to bright orange, according to all the witnesses. It was traveling blunt end first. It traveled quite slowly across the valley over their heads and just managed to top the mountain on the other side, or the hill on the other side of the valley, which is that hill behind which there are these dwellings of which I spoke a moment ago. Well, the kids all said, as I say, "Gee, what was that?" And one of the elder boys, whose name was Nunn, a very, very intelligent boy of 14 years old, had remembered that at school they had been asked if they saw a meteor or anything like that, and saw anything fall from the sky, that the Geological Survey would be interested in getting the remains of it or anything that was found on the ground. And he said, "Come on, that may be a bolide or something, and something looks as if it's landed behind that hill." Because I must point out, yes, I'm sorry, that the kids all state categorically that this object, this large glowing object, which appeared to be about the size of a house, seemed to pause when it topped the hill, and then to sink, instead of going on down in the sort of trajectory, it stopped and sank slowly down behind the hill. And they could see this light pulsing behind the crest of the hill. And Nunn said, the 14-year-old said, "Come on, let's run up there. Something may have landed, and we may be able to get something to the Geological Survey," which I think is pretty bright and intelligent. So the kids ran up the blacktop, taking a few minutes, turned left on the dirt road, crossed the railway track, went up around behind the hill, and as they ran between the houses, several of the people would come out on the verandas, and they said, "What's going on?" And one of the younger kids said, "A flying saucer has landed," picking up, I mean, he one of the little ones, you see. Mrs. May and a young man aged 18, who had just joined the National Guard, I think, or the services or something, was visiting with her. Some other people came out, and they grabbed a big flashlight, because it was just getting dark, and they saw this huge thing lying in the field about 2 fields away, up by the crest. So they all gathered together. There were, in the end, I'm sorry, I was wrong in saying there were 14 kids playing. The total party in the end was 14. So there must have been, there was May, Mrs. May and the young man, and then there were 11 kids, and then there was a little one, a little 5-year-old, also named Nunn, if I remember right, who was of one of the houses, and he tagged along behind. And to me, he is one of the most important witnesses in the whole case because of his extraordinary honesty. When we asked him certain things, he said, "But, mister, I couldn't see. I'm too low down. There was grass in between me." I mean, these kids are the most straightforward, honest witnesses I've ever known. However, they all started out, and they ran up the ridge where there's a path.
Pardon me, didn't the little boy have his dog with him?
Well, a dog, a collie dog, belonging to another house, not Mrs. May. Nor the 18-year-old, but there was a collie-like dog that was there. Yep, thank you, John, for reminding me of that. It's a very important thing in the case. It started off with them. Well, they came to a gate which was chained, and they unchained it, but being good country folk, When they've gone through the gate, they rechain the gate. It's rather
you know the height
point.
Of that fence?
That gate was, I think, a 5 bar, but it was up almost by my neck, and I'm exactly 6 foot tall. It was a high gate.
You were actually down there after this event took place.
We arrived there.
You investigated it.
Every point of it.
With Gray Barker.
Gray Barker arrived while we were there, but we had some other friends, some scientists up from Monsanto Chemical, one of whom is a great photographer, Walter. And I photographed every single thing of this. We mapped it and surveyed it. We searched the ground almost inch by inch. And as the facts fall into place, I'll tell you all of them. But this gate is important. It was a high gate, and they rechained it, and they went on up this path, by which time it was very nearly dark. And they turned the flash on. The dog by this time had run ahead. Now, what they saw up there, they were within paces of this thing. And I think enormous fortitude was shown by those people in walking up to a completely unknown object, which they pointed out to me, a house, an outhouse, sort of little barn. And I said, how big was it? And they said, about that size. We measured that little two-story barn, but it was 22 foot high. They said this thing had landed with the nose, the blunt end, down. So it formed not exactly a pear, but it was more like an ace of spades, sort of standing up in the field, sticking up. And they walked up to within certainly 50 paces of it, according to their description, at which time it was standing upright and making no noise, but was pulsing with very bright light from cherry red to very pale orange. I'll jump ahead of my story for a minute and say it wasn't until way at the end, when we had questioned all these people, or at least all the kids, together in various combinations of 2, 3, 4, and 5, and singly, and then mixed them up again, and for 3 days we went on, and they never deviated from their stories one single iota. And if you can tell me that a bunch of 12 kids can get together and make up a lie and stick to it for 10 days under the most grueling circumstances, because there were professional reporters there.
Did you interrogate them individually?
Individually, in combinations of different 2s and 3s and 4s and all together, and over 3 days, and there was never in the evidence, and we have it taped and we have it written down, there was never a mistake. Some added a few touches which were not exaggerations. Some of them became a little doubtful as to whether it was just as they said the first time or the second, but they never deviated in their overall story, and I think that's very, very a powerful factor in evaluating the whole thing. And it wasn't until right at the end that one of the younger kids, I don't remember which one now, I said to him, well, weren't you frightened of being burnt with this thing? He said, but mister, it wasn't hot. We'd naturally, everybody had supposed that because of this tremendous light that the thing was hot and was pulsing. Oh, no, no, no. He said, it's like a neon sign. He said, it's not hot. It wasn't hot. And they had kept on saying that it was black. And I said, but if it's pulsing cherry red to orange, how do you say it's black? And they said, well, it was obviously a black object which was giving out this light. All right. Well, they go along. They lit the flash. The dog had run ahead. And all around this object, there was a thick mist, looked like a ground mist, a patch of it, lying on the side of the hill. Now, you do get these patches of mist at sundown, sometimes in little culls up on the hill. And they had assumed that it was that.
Well, they stratify, Ivan. They very seldom lie along the side of a hill, not as much as they would on a definite stratum.
Excuse me. In that climate, especially after those tremendously heavy rains, I have seen these little sort of scooped-out culls on the side of a hill actually filled with mist, and it's sort of spilling over the edge, almost like it was treacle.
Actually, it holds there like water would with a definite top level, doesn't it?
No, it's stuck on the side in some cases.
Is that right?
You get a patch right over an area where the soil may be particularly moist, and just for a few minutes while it's coming out at sundown, you get just like a round blob on the side, and they're used to that, and they thought that's what it was. But the dog ran into this mist, going barking at this object, according to their story. He immediately set up a howl and took off practically with the speed of the light, down to the village, and was subsequently found having vomited all over a veranda and subsequently died. Now,
in other words, evidence of poison.
Yeah, leave that aside for the moment. In other words, it was a gas. They said there was a ghastly smell, and this is what was in the report, a ghastly smell of hot molten metal. And they got the smell, although only one of them bent down and got his head in the gas. And that was this...
One of the youngsters?
No, the 18-year-old.
The 18-year-old boy.
Yes, I have to skip ahead of my story because this is what happened. They had lit this flash. They were looking at the object, and then suddenly one of the kids behind said, look, up in the tree. Now, there was one oak tree growing isolated right on the top of the ridge. And there's a little pathway at the bottom. This oak tree was on a bank, a 3-foot bank on the left of the pathway. The big object was a little bit further down the hill to the right, if you follow me. This is to the left. The first branch going out of the oak tree, which was a clear branch, when measured from the underneath of the branch to the path on which they were standing, was 12 foot 6 inches above. Now, this kid pointed up to this branch, and underneath the branch, apparently suspended in the air, was a creature or a thing or an object about the size of a very heavy set man, but obviously contained in some kind of suit, or what looks from their drawings, their composite drawing, they all did sketches, and we put a composite of it. It looks exactly like one of the most modern naval diving suits, which is solid. The person is inside. It has a pair of artificial arms in front that you can crank. Mm. The head goes into a headpiece, which has a glass plate in the front, silicon glass plate, and it's got lights in it so that you can see in the dark. And the whole thing is suspended in water, mostly by gas tanks, so that there's no great weight on the wire. So the wire that lets it down is nothing much more than an anchor, and has the telephone cable and so on going. Now, this thing, for all the world, like that in the drawings. At first, they thought it was a 12-foot giant thing standing there, because the bottom half of it, if it had any, was lost behind a lot of little tall grass and briars and
this
stuff.
This mist, too, covered it.
No, the mist was down to the right by the big object.
Down to the right.
This was perfectly clear up to the left on this little bank. And there was first the bank, and then all this vegetation, this herbage growing on it, and this thing was sticking out of the top of the herbage, but underneath the first limb of the tree. You follow me? Mm-hmm. They thought it was a coon at first, because they saw what they thought were two eyes. They described them as being pale blue, held close together, and like very dim flashlight beams, but coming out of the plate glass window on the front of the head of this whatever it was. They were fixed beams, but the thing was turning slowly around, waving from left to right and right to left, as if it was searching the horizon with these beams. I may interject here that particular point is the highest in the whole area, and standing where that object was, you can see 14 light beacons scattered over the mountains, away over West Virginia and down into Virginia and right back up the other side. In other words, somebody suggested that this thing was looking for its colleagues, or was looking to find out where it was. But apparently when the flashlight came on, the object tilted over so that these two little beams came down and concentrated on them, and then immediately began to silently drift through the air, sort of in a half circle, towards them and around to the left, to go down from its left, to go down towards the big pulsing object, the red thing that was lying in the field. So scared were they when this tremendous thing came towards them, which was of a sort of aluminum grey colour, but reflecting the colour of the bushes and such, which gave the idea of greenness, because one little man, green man, always, and that's supposed to be a newspaper edition. They were so scared, the guy dropped the flash, and he bent over to pick it up, and in doing so, he got his head into this ground mist. Well, to jump ahead again, he became so violently ill as a result, they called a doctor half an hour later down to the house, and who didn't use a stomach pump, but everything short of it. And also, it seemed to have had an extraordinary psychological effect on him, because he was a fine, upstanding young man. But he absolutely and positively refused, even the next day, to go back up that hill. It seemed, and he was in a frightful state that night. The doctor was really worried about him. He was completely knocked out. However, but of course they all took off, and I don't blame them when this thing started to sail through the air towards them.
How about the gate?
Well, I know, John, you like the gate part. I got this from the littlest one of all. I think his name was Johnny Nunn. I was asking them at various points, well, what happened when you came to the gate? And no, not that kind of gate at all. This was a 5-barred gate, and there was the space between the hunks of wood was certainly not more than a foot.
About 12 inches.
12 mm-hmm. inches. Mm-hmm. I said, well, what happened when you came to the gate? And he said, well, I don't know, don't rightly know, mister. He said, I didn't try the gate. He said, I went under the hedge because I'm small. But he said, I know that Mrs. May took it in one. She went clean over the top. And he said, some of them, I think, went through the gate, mister. Most of them couldn't tell at that point what they had done. But anyhow, they cleared the gate in one.
The Olympics missed some good candidates.
They sure did.
Well, it would be impossible to take the time to open up the gate again.
Well, they weren't taking time, brother. Not then. They were making time. They weren't taking it. And they were right back down to the house. Well, to finish off this part of the story, we only found, much later on, after a considerable amount of questioning all over the district, we found a farmer who lived on a mountain, on a hill, about 3 miles away to the southeast. who was the only person who had had a pair of binoculars on this object. He thought that the house was on fire, but it began to look funny, and he couldn't see very well. It was about three mountain peaks or three hill peaks away. So he went inside, he got out an old pair of binoculars, which he showed me. They were pre-World War I. And he is the only person we know who's able to state or make any statement as to what happened to that great big object. What happened to the little one, I don't know. It looked to everybody as if it was trying to get back into the big one. But he watched the big object, and he said that for a matter of 10 to 15 minutes, it continued to pulse. And it pulsed the same colors, but getting redder and redder and weaker amount of light. And he felt very sure that the whole object itself was diminishing in size. And he said it finally disappeared about 20 minutes later in a pinpoint of light, and then it was complete darkness. Now, when the gang who had been up to it got back down to the houses, a lot of people began to gather. There was a great rumpus. They sent for a doctor, and there was a telephone at one of the houses, and they telephoned for the local police to come. But the local police were already out investigating something else that I shall just end off with in a moment. They called a lot of the men together, and they got shotguns, and they formed a posse, and they went up to investigate. At least they said they did. They were back in extremely short order, stating categorically that they could find nothing. But they did not get going for at least half an hour after the incident, by which time, according to this farmer, this thing had winked out. It did not go away. It had just disappeared in situ. Therefore, they may have been perfectly honest in saying that they had not seen anything. And I think they may have been honest in saying that they went up there because they did report this perfectly ghastly and nauseating smell of molten metal. It's peculiar. Now, where was the road patrol? This is what we found out when we got there. That's that side of the story. We then started asking around all over the district for the tape recorder and such, did you see the thing? And they all said, oh, that there flying saucer, ha, ha, ha. No, but we saw the meteor. Well, then we started mapping. We had a big aerial map of the whole area, and we started mapping where they, at what time they said they saw said meteor. And then we came up with one very interesting discovery. There had not been one object, there had been six.
Six different objects?
Six identical.
Identical.
But different objects. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Mm-hmm.
They were all traveling, let us say, to make it perfectly simple, from about north to south. The one on the east side was spotted all along a line by about 30, 40 people. It passed right over the Sutton Airport and was then reported during that night all the way down to Alabama in a perfectly straight line, according to what newspaper and other reports we could get.
That was just one of them?
That was the most easternmost of them. They were traveling along a straight front, almost exactly 5 miles apart. The only time they appeared to have deviated from that, from the reports, is when they went around a hill or a mountain. But they were keeping on a steady course from north to south, traveling not too fast. I should imagine we asked the kids, well, put your finger in the air and pass it from left to right. Show us how fast it, how long it took to get across Flatwoods. And it took,
well, that would be about jet speed, as you demonstrated here.
Oh, no, sir. No. Jets would go... gone like that.
Depends on their altitude.
Yeah, this thing was not more than 200 foot up from where they were standing. And it took, I would say, radio time 25 seconds to pass from the hill 45-degree angle from there to there. No, but the way they've showed it, was good. They were going pretty slowly. There was a steady speed. All right, eastern one, number one, went straight on down, got away. Number two was this Flatwood one that landed. I call that a landing. Number three came around a hill, went over a road, and crashed into the side of a mountain. That was Gray Barker and I, and Eddie went up and investigated that. And that's where we found this peculiar stuff.
Was the ground seared at that point?
Well, if I may leave that for a moment, I'll come to it. Number three crashed on another mountaintop, on the land of two remarkable young men who have farmed their farm all their lives, although they are both cripples. They do it all by tractor. But they cannot farm the knolls on their upland because it's full of rocks and so on, they can't get in. So they couldn't persuade anybody to go and investigate this knoll where they had seen this one land for their eyes. That's number four. Number five blew up in the sky right in front of six members of our National Caving Society, Cave Exploration Society, at the house of some people called the McLeans. They were sitting on the veranda after having been out on a caving expedition, and they saw this thing come around the mountains, were amazed, and it blew up right over some fields. And Mrs. Williams, one of the members who were there, told me afterwards with complete innocence that a lot of kind of ashes shot out of it and scattered all over the land. I said to him, and you're supposed to be a geologist, and you didn't even go over to pick up some? And number six missed and went right on and was seen all the way down in a parallel line to Alabama almost as well. So one went on, two landed, three crashed into this mountaintop, four crashed into a mountaintop, five blew up in the air, and six got away. There's some very good reason for that. Now,
sounds like a series of unguided missiles, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? But except for this one, the landing one, if it was a missile, if it had missed that mountaintop, which it did, it would have sailed right on over the next valley and hit the next hill on the side. Mm. But it didn't. It had stopped and landed. And I know that it landed because where it landed, it had pushed a circular depression into the ground, but exactly vertical to the center of the earth. Do you see what I mean?
I see.
Not a slosh downwards.
In other words, it wasn't a glancing blow.
Not
it was
a glancing,
direct, exactly. Where it rested.
It had come down, and it would have been weight, and a lot of weight, because the grass there was an overgrown field, and it was waist high, and full of little twigs and bushes. All that was completely flattened. The ground itself was flattened, and there were some considerable stones, not boulders, but stones the size of a man's head lying in there, and they'd been pushed right down into the ground.
Well, this thing had considerable mass and weight, then.
Definitely. And also, at the three points equidistant around it, there were three holes jammed into the ground at the edge of the circle, which looked exactly as if a cart horse with a foot, with a hoof about 2 foot across, had been jammed down into the ground, as if it had stood on a tripod. That's what it looked like. Exactly similar marks we found up where number three crashed. There were five of us. Eddie Schoenberger, Gray Barker, Raymond Walters, and one other gentleman from Monsanto, and myself. We had reports of this, very reliable, I will not have time to go into. We searched this mountainside on our hands and knees, clawing our way up because it was so steep. We found nothing until we got to the top. And over the top, there was a little swamp up there. With small trees behind the big forest, tall trees. And in there I found a huge, like a skid mark, which had knocked these bushes down. And there was a depression in that, and also two of these tremendous hoof-like things pushed into the ground. And beyond it, a whole mass of little pieces, little coils of white plastic-like material scattered all over the ground. I'll tell you about that.
Ivan, going back to the depression, how large was that depression?
Well, the depression itself was about 15 foot across. We measured it, 15 or 16 foot, but you couldn't, of course, tell exactly where it ran out to the side because it was a dish-shaped depression, a saucer shape. Because number three here, he thought, the fellow who saw it, he thought that this was a flaming aeroplane came around the corner of the hill. This one we investigated. Well, anyhow, to conclude this part, Eddie Schoenberger happened to be looked back up at the trees from the direction in which number three had come before it had apparently crashed in the swamp, and he said, look at that. And there was a whole treetop knocked off, and several other branches, all recently shattered. You always make a hole through the top of the trees.
Was there any odor around there?
No, because we were 5-6 days off. This was about a week after the other one had occurred. Because,
well, wasn't there, I think I heard that there was the local editor of the newspaper or one of the members of the police department.
Oh,
he went over and got down on the ground on all fours, and he noticed that there was still some stench remaining there.
As a matter of fact, first of all, the people reported it at Flatwoods. Then the posse went up, and they were so nauseated, they wanted to get out of there as quick as possible, and they said it was absolutely overpowering. In the meantime, the road patrol was unable to come because they were investigating number three, but the local police arrived from Braxton County. It's not Saxon County, I'm sorry, from the town of Sutton. They got down on their hands and knees. They didn't have to. They noticed the smell. And the very charming gentleman I met down there, the owner of the Republican paper, this too, is a Republican and Democratic paper. The head of the Democratic paper was deeply interested in this, and he brought Mrs. May and the young fellow, whose name I can't remember, up to New York for a show, I think, with Ed Sullivan or something here on this. And they were gone while we were down there. But this other gentleman had personally been up there that night, because he's very, very much alive to local affairs and happenings, and he was up there right smart during the night, and he smelt it too. But the next morning, there was a lot of confusion. There's always red herrings drawn across these things. A lot of people started turning up, and they said that the grass there was covered with oil. Well, it wasn't. All the grass there is covered with a kind of oil. It's coiled oil grass or tar grass. You can pass your hand over a whip of it when it's growing and pull it up, and your hand will be sticky afterwards and has a rather lovely aromatic smell. That, I am assured by all the local people there, had nothing whatsoever to do with this perfectly ghastly stench which had occurred from this thing or whatever it was that landed. Well, just to round up this whole thing, Walter, and for the benefit of our friends down there who want to hear this report on tape, there are certain aspects of the whole phenomena which are of great interest, and that is this, that at that particular time, which was September, I think 1953 or 52, I can't remember, there had been some enormous forest fires in Texas, Louisiana, Alabama. And we were receiving in New York here even a very high smoke count in the air. In fact, we had a haze, you recall it, mm-hmm. And we had white ash land. Point number one. Point number two on this particular score, all of which was pointed out to me by the chemist down there, that block of hills over which these six objects came looked down into a series of valleys running parallel. And those valleys are filled with coal mines which are belching smoke all the time. Monsanto chemical plant and other enormous chemical plants and other installations for which that part of the country is famous. Belching smoke and carbonaceous gases of all kinds. The wind happened to be blowing straight up these valleys up this mountain. There was the smoke from the forest fires, there was all this accumulation, and there was a barrier of carbonaceously filled air rising at the heads of these valleys. But object number one and object number six were to the left and right of that area, and they seemed to have got away. And as it was pointed out to me, that all the others, it looked as if as soon as they hit a highly polluted atmosphere, something went wrong with either, if they were animals, their breathing, if they were machines, with their air intake, or some other words, that if they are extraterrestrial creatures of one kind or another, they were apparently doing a swoop down into our atmosphere to take a look-see and then get in formation and go on up again. And what actually happened was they hit some of the wrong kind of air and something went wrong with them. They went out of control. The Flatwoods one was able to land and have a look around to see what had happened to his colleagues or where he was. Numbers two and three hit hills, but fell out of control, and number three and four and number five blew up in the air. Come to the end of what I had to say, really. There's an enormous amount more to it, which I could go on almost indefinitely, but I think that's enough detail for anybody to be asked to absorb at one go. My personal opinion, I'd just like to throw in, is that none of those people were telling lies, those from Flatwoods especially, that the 400-odd other people whom we interviewed, including the young man who reported to the police number three incident, the crash, and those young farmers, were certainly not lying. They were a highly skeptical group. They did not believe in flying saucers if they'd heard of them. But they did say that there were these objects in the sky. They had their times down pat. I mean, we'd say, well, what time was it? And they said, well, let me see now. Dawn comes and so on, and I usually put my porch light on and so on, so that would make it. And they pin it down within the minute. And they all jibed all over. And their descriptions gave exactly the course of these things on an aerial map. And I don't think those people were lying. I do think there were those six objects there. But what they were, of course, I have the foggiest notion. The last payoff was, John, this. That we did have this funny white stuff analyzed. My friends took it down to one of the labs in Monsanto, and they couldn't be much better there. They have this enormous spectrographic analysis machinery, and they were unable to find out what it was. It seemed to be of a plastic nature, but to be of an organic structure. The only thing they could think was that it looked more like the dried-up skin of a snake's egg than anything else. Howsomever, one of the lab assistants down there managed to soften it up. They've been trying to soften it up in everything. He said, why don't you try water? Which they did. And one of these little rolls of stuff, which were only about the size of my little finger, when stretched out, measured 9.5 inches. And I would like to know what snake's egg, found in the United States or anywhere else, from which you could get a strip 9.5 inches long. The parting shot was a humorous one made by John DuBarry. When I told him about all this, he said, uh-oh. Perhaps they were space people, but perhaps they're reptiles and were looking for somewhere to lay an egg.
Well, our thanks to Arvin Sanderson and also Long John Nibble. This is a program that was made in about 1953, recapturing the investigation that Arvin made of the Braxton County Monster in September of 1952. Ivan Sanderson, the famous author, world-famous traveler, geologist, biologist, and has written many books about the unexplained, unidentified flying objects and many other things. He did this story for True Magazine at that time and the North American newspaper, Alas. They did this program on WOR in New York City. Long John Neville's show at that time for our program, which we were doing here in Charleston on the all-night program. This was an answer to a group of students at Morris Harvey College, and Tom Baumgartner and other people would like us to repeat the famous Braxton County Monster at Flatwoods, West Virginia, in September 1952. Thank you for listening. Good night to all.